So today we can bring from data directly text, or from text we can generate video. But the interpretation, the recommendation, the actionability, the story building, for now that is generally for humans.
I'm super excited today to speak to Joris De Bruijn.
I think many companies wish to be customer-centric, client-centric, put the customer at the heart of the company. Then they dig into the numbers only and spreadsheet and presentations.
Joris is CEO of IC.
We are specialized in behavioral research.
You can actually measure the impact of your campaigns on social media.
I always think in possibilities, a game plan, and then adaptation. It's all about how the algorithm is being steered, all about the speed, about focus. And that influences a lot because it's very easy to be completely overloaded with the noise.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unmatched. I'm super excited today to speak to Joris De Bruijn. Joris is CEO of IC, which is a super interesting marketing company that does something that not a lot of companies do these days. And we're going to start getting into that in a second. But Joris, welcome to Unmatched.
Hey, Ioana. Very excited to be here.
Joris, tell me who you are. What's your story and why do you do what you do?
Okay. Joris, born and raised as a Belgian from Flanders, so from the north. Some of the football fans will know my last name. It's a very famous player called Kevin De Bruyne. He's okay. One of the best midfielders. My first
Are
name
you related?
He's my cousin.
Oh, okay.
Not really, but at customs, I often make that joke and it seems to engage.
And it works.
It works. It works, absolutely. Okay. So beyond being Belgian and not really a professional football player, I'm into market research, bit of a nerdy kind of scene, but I guess what's typical about me is curiosity. I love anything in between technology and business. And yeah, that's what I studied. And that's also what I do now as a professional.
So you're CEO of IC. Tell us a little bit what IC is all about and what you guys do there.
We are specialized in behavioral research. Our story got started, Oana, by bringing eye tracking online. And basically, we observed that lots of the market research was still being conducted purely on a questionnaire basis, online. That was already very special.
Yeah. Very advanced.
Very advanced. And so we noticed that with eye tracking, you get some very interesting kind of data on visibility and attention, but it was clunky. So you need to, you know, bring people to a central location, hard to calibrate. And we thought, what about doing webcam-based eye tracking? And, you know, a decade later, we are having a whole suite of different methodologies that we have, you know, entered on different products. And today we test packaging, but also social media, TV commercials. So that's a bit of my world, helping marketeers like yourself in improving the ROI of their marketing investments.
Now, what I'm very, very interested to hear from you today, because when I came across IC, I was so fascinated with the idea that you can actually measure the impact of your campaigns on social media, which is one of the things that nowadays, I don't think we're used to doing that a lot. A lot of what we do on social media these days is it's almost like too much into the organic or just paid. And then when you do that, the only sort of metrics that you get is the back end of the influencers, the creators that you work with. And that's what you kind of, on that back end, that's what you need to trust. That's data that you need to use. And then if you do paid, you then do get, you know, the typical smart links to kind of see if anything is going towards sales or if it's redirecting to a website or whatever your smart link is all about. Now, I know that when you guys goes, I don't know, five steps forward, because as far as I understand, it tracks how consumers actually interact with the content. And I would love for you to go a little bit into that.
So indeed, Ioana, I think, you know, many marketeers are very excited when they have a lot of shares, a lot of likes, lots of engagement on the typical metrics. But the question is always like, how do we generate that engagement? And so what our team has been focusing on is Can we drive attention? Can we drive emotional engagement? These are two very important components, I believe. You know, what is not seen, of course, will not convert. And then if you don't engage, you obviously will not create that kind of interaction with your content, right? So from an emotional point of view, we have been looking at facial expression. From an attention point of view, eye tracking, what I mentioned before. And then beyond those methods, what I'm always interested in is within a certain context of a platform, how does your content exactly resonate and how can you optimize it? Talking about TikTok, for example, the right type of speed, the right type of music. But back in the days, I very vividly remember when Twitter went from text to basically a video format and anything in between in terms of still images. That sounds all very long time ago. But obviously, it was always a bit of a change in how you would translate that into advertising pieces. Yeah. And what we like to do is to understand the steps in between how to create that engagement.
So what's the technology behind it? How does it actually work?
Yeah. Typically, what we do is we make a replica of the platform, let's say an Instagram or a TikTok. We inject a set of different ads on a persona. We let the respondent engage with the content as such, and then we see what is breaking through. Afterwards, of course, we go into depth in terms of evaluating the piece of content on an emotional kind of scale, but also explicit questions. And so there, of course, we want to have a right reference across the board for an industry.
So there's no way for people to actually lie because you're actually tracking how their eyes move across the content. So they will know when they're losing interest or then when they're picking their interest with the content, right?
Exactly. And they don't know which piece of ad is being tested.
Mm-hmm. So what are the things that you've, you know, kind of found interesting in this methodology? What things have you found that are relevant, you know, for us as marketeers to keep in mind when we create this type of content on social media?
I think you need to be very much aware of the type of platform, right? You need to be very much aware of what type of category that you're playing in. You need to be very much aware what type of audience you're focusing on. Thinking about the Gen Z audience, of course, you want to go for a TikTok-like. But that needs to resonate also with your target group in terms of brands. And I think one of the most important elements that I've been seeing is to match your right target group, your right segments with the right platform. Then you need to build as a brand the right narrative. Yeah. What we as a company, of course, can help with is how to measure that. But thinking about you, Anna, in sports, for example, you have a set of different attributes that you wish to convey, depending on, you know, the platform that you're looking at. Today, for example, Red Bull is fantastic in promoting pure content. So only the product as such is very implicit. And I love how they're able to build pure content streams, being it on sports, of course, which is huge investment, again, connected to your world. But it can be also in different verticals.
Mm-hmm. So maybe let's pause a little bit here because I think that one of the biggest challenges that I've seen in our industry, and I would say just industry in marketing at large, not necessarily in my vertical, but in, you know, across the board on social media, when marketeers are creating the content for different platforms, it sort of does not come as natural as we would think to create, you know, native content for the platform that we're on. So the traditional way of doing it is you're creating one big campaign, and out of that big campaign, you're slicing and dicing, and you're like pushing content here on Instagram, you're pushing content there on TikTok, on Facebook, whatever, you know. So maybe you can shed some light on what are the platform specifics that we should be paying attention to moving forward?
Awesome. I still vividly remember when a 60-second TV commercial was being posted on a platform like Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's say that doesn't really work. So a Twitter platform would be rather 3 or 6 seconds maximum. Facebook, you have a bit more time. So it's all about the speed of the environment. It's all about how the algorithm is being steered, of course. It's all about how to engage into the right hooks. And I think there's a lot of evolution also happening. So music has always been there, but it is not as, or it has not been as dominant as, for example, now on a TikTok. Yeah. So the sound in terms of activation was typically on a platform like Facebook only when you click on a product. And that influences a lot. When do you attribute a brand? When do you bring it in image? Not only at the end, I hope, but maybe also at the beginning or in the middle, or have a small tag. These are some of the tactics that are very important and that can be either cross-platform or specifically for a platform being translated.
We'll go back to the conversation in a moment, but for now, I've got a game changer for your content strategy. Now look, the one question I'm being asked over and over again is, how do you manage to have a full-time job with all the responsibility that comes with and post content and record a podcast and keeping it all together? Now, no, I don't always have it together. But when I started all this, I did struggle until I discovered a tool that completely changed the game for me. So let me share. It's called Planable, and it's the best content planning tool out there. Now, Planable has been my content planning tool for a whole year now, but I was so excited when they reached out to sponsor the podcast. Now, picture this. I'm planning and crafting my posts, and I'm seeing them exactly as they'll appear live across all the different platforms I'm on, all from one single dashboard. I mean, mind-blowing. And you can easily collaborate with your team, get content approved in literally seconds. And that is the beauty of Planable. Now, you can head over to planable.io and sign up for a free plan today, and you will absolutely love it. You can trust me. And here's the cherry on the top. The lovely team at Planable is giving you now 30% off the first 3 months when you upgrade to any plan that fits your needs. All you need to do is use the code PLANNABLE30 at checkout, and you're all set to transform the way you manage your marketing content. So next time you wonder how I do it all, well, here's the real answer. I don't. I get help from Planable. And what would you think is where this is all going with on social media? Because, you know, as much as we are on it and very much in it right now and kind of like trying to untangle, you know, what kind of the platform works like and how we can adapt to the platform. What I know from experience and looking back at history is that this is just another stage of the evolution of technology. And you're in the middle of it. You're the kind of at the forefront of what technology is all about today. Where is this going? Like, what's the next thing after social media that we need to be aware of?
Wow, that's a big question. I think now there's a lot of course on AI. I spoke a couple of weeks ago at Davos in Switzerland, and the omnipresent topic was all about AI. I'm very curious how AI generated content will influence some of the platforms. It is already today, and some of the platforms are struggling with the curation there. Some don't want to, like a platform like X is keeping it very liberal. Whereas others say, no, we have a responsibility to take. And I think it's not only up to the platforms, but it's also about the brands to take the right responsibility. So to use AI-generated content within certain frameworks to see, okay, what is the type of creativity that we wish to generate? What do we stand for as a brand? And that it maybe brings quick kind of executions to life, but that the AI does not necessarily steer all the content. If that makes sense. But yeah. It's very exciting, I think. We just need to see how it will be iterating along the future.
Are you worried about it at all?
No.
What's your personal point of view?
I'm not so worried. I do believe that as marketeers, we have a responsibility to take. And I feel, especially for insights, it's an amazing time. So today we can bring from data directly text, or from text we can generate video. But the interpretation, the recommendation, the actionability, the story building, for now, that is generally for humans. And I also feel that brand building for now is all about humans to see what the narrative of the brand is going to be. Go ahead.
So that's an interesting point, because I always love to say the future of marketing is human. And I would love to get your point of view on this, because you're a very data-driven, you know, person and data-driven company that you're kind of working for and fronting. And, you know, in general, as a marketer, I think that data is amazing for decision-making. And I think that it's shaped in such a different way, the way that we can interact with our consumers, the way we can understand them, the way that we can use those insights in a much more organized, efficient, quick way of making those decisions. However, my personal observation is that maybe we're going slightly in some cases a little bit too far with the data. And I feel like sometimes the human aspect of understanding the deep insights, you know, just like you guys are tracking eye movement, and that goes just like one layer beyond just capturing data and interpreting them. You're actually understanding how people are deeply interacting with what you're behaving exactly, right? So, you know, there's this idea of, you know, having just real conversations with consumers in a room and just asking random people things beyond the data to kind of get a better context of the reality of how people actually interact with your services and consumers, products. What's your point of view of that? Like, what's the human part and the data part, and how they should kind of work together?
It's about the fusion, Oana. And I think, you know, what we truly want to understand is why. So if you have your social media engagement statistics, you want to see why that is. What I love is to measure behavior as such from a visibility and attention point of view, from an emotional point of view, but also from a transactional point of view. For example, we do virtual shopping. We let you shop within an e-com environment. So it's about having that full story as a human in terms of interpretation of other humans by looking at the behavior. If we look a bit at the next frontier, it can be complemented with passive data sources, for example, looking at history of consumers when you're navigating and you're not necessarily aware of certain behavior. That becomes very interesting if we measure 1,000 or 10,000 consumers that are willing to share their data in return for some level of remuneration. Or imagine, going back to my AI point from our previous part, maybe syndicated synthetic data can help us there. And so humans looking at behavior complemented with maybe AI-generated data, but all of that being fused. And I think ultimately is a human that needs to make sense of it.
But the question for me is always, how do you know what questions to ask? Because I always think that, you know, like output is coming from the input, right? So if you want great output, you need to have great input. And so if you don't really know what the relevant questions are, what the right questions to ask are, how can you make sure that the output data is correct? Because it could be just very generic at times, and it doesn't really give you the really deep consumer insights that you kind of need to understand the behaviors of the people behind the products that, you know, you're creating and they are using. So how do you look at that front end, you know, the input side of things?
Yeah. It all depends, you know, what stage of the marketing funnel do we need to ask which type of question. If it's really at the front end, as you say, maybe we're not aware of the question that we need to ask. What is the new trend? What is really moving? And we just are oblivious of that. And I think there, some trend spotting can be very interesting. But also you have the input from, and maybe this sounds very old school, but like a call center of a firm. I've seen also consumers connecting to the firm and actually releasing those new insights. What about this? What about that? And then some of the firms that are very mature to say, okay, this is old school kind of data, but we can translate that into a new vision and maybe opportunities to extend or to get into a new segment of product. What I love, depending on the category, you have sometimes markets that are way more advanced than others. Skincare, for example, you have a lot of movement in Korea. So some markets can be more leading than others. If we think about sustainability, there is maybe something more that resonates in Germany for certain categories than in them for some others. So yeah, what input you receive as a company, how do you process that? And then looking at what are your key markets where consumers have the right kind of maturity that might be translated into insights for others.
I've recently seen, I think one of the founders or the CEO of a brand called Waterdrop. You might know it. It's a brand based in Vienna, and it's basically kind of flavor drops that you put in water so that it gets a better flavor and then you drink it. And the other day they were saying that every month they have a meeting, their, you know, leadership team, and they're inviting one Waterdrop consumer on the call to be kind of asked all of the different questions from the team about how they're using the product, how they're interacting, what their day looks like, and where does the product kind of become part of that day and that lifestyle, and what problems do they face in using the consumers, the product, is anything that they would want them to change. And it was so funny because there was like this Zoom call with all the people in the meeting rooms, you know, and on different, like in different locations. And then the consumer was in the car taking the call. And it was so funny. But in the end, I thought, this is so great. You don't, you know, you need the data to capture massive amounts of information and distill it and get some tangible information. But you also need to speak to one person at the time and get those deep insights, right?
And I think many companies wish to be customer-centric, client-centric, put the customer at the heart of the company, but then they dig into the numbers only and spreadsheets and presentations. So obviously, I love quantitative data, but bringing that to life with true respondents, with true consumers that are the heart of your product that's can give you the insight, I think that's core. And you also need to see that it's not just at the marketeers, but that it is at the board level, that it is within your executive team, that it also lives, and that you stay connected to your clients, to your consumers. And if that is not the case, you can drift really far away and be in that ivory tower steering and maybe talking to your communications agencies or to your digital marketing people, but not necessarily being in touch. So I would highly recommend to always put that as a focus point, because it's too easy to be in 2D Excel.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of, I also think the same. I think that that's actually the easy part, you know. You get a bunch of data, you look at it, you distill it, you put it in a PowerPoint, and you're just saying, okay, these are the highlights. But to take, you know, the extra step of actually getting in front of real consumers and facing them, you know, and saying, okay, here's the product, what do you think? That's it. It requires such a level of commitment with being consumer centric, as you say, that I feel that it's not necessarily so mainstream yet.
No, absolutely. I agree with you there. So let's stress that we need to put the consumer at the table and engage with them. Ideally, we have a quant set, and then we have individuals explaining the why behind it. So things get to life.
So I want to go back to something you said before with regards to brand building, right? So on social media, we want to do both things. We want to be sales oriented and, you know, sell the product, especially on platforms like TikTok, which now has TikTok Shop and so on and so forth. And somehow I see that there's a little bit the danger that we become a little bit too performance oriented in this direction. Yeah, exactly, or store focused. How do we make sure that we continue to build brand on social media at the same time as selling? What would be the best way in your opinion?
I think you need to see as a brand what you're really good at and what content you can claim. So if there is an area, and that can be very simple. For example, we did a study with Scotch. It's online. It's a case, in fact. And they had a lot of engagement with how to use products. So it sounds very logical, but basically people were looking like, how can I use these products in this kind of problem. And so that's the key content that they have been building. Obviously, when you have great influencers, that can be some kind of a leverage to engage with a lot of, you know, bigger audiences. But you also need to see that that is very genuine. Is there any specific kind of area that you think about, Juana?
I mean, I'm just thinking in general, you know, for brands, you know, for our listeners that are marketers and are, you know, especially for brand builders. I think this is an interesting white space that we need to think about more and more, that how do we use social media for brand building, you know, as opposed to just focusing on selling the product, which is so easy to do, especially nowadays, you know?
Key would be your values. So what are your values? What do you really stand for? What is the equity that you really want to obtain from the future? But also, where are you today? And of course, we have aspirations to grow the brand into certain directions. But I think it always starts where who we are. And if that is not solid, if that is not matching the same tone of voice in your communication, then you cannot evolve over time.
And who we are is so difficult to remember, figure out, not forget. I don't know. It tends to kind of slip away these days, right? Because there's so much noise in the market. There's so many brands out there. There's so many campaigns, right? There's just like noise, and social media is all about that content all the time. What do we do as just people, right? So if we put, you know, our kind of like our hats, respective hats aside, and we just speak as people, how do we, you know, from your point of view, how do we manage this amount of information that us individuals have to process on a daily basis as well?
I think it's often about focus. So what do you really care about, and where do you want to build your filters? Because it's very easy to be completely overloaded with the noise. At the same time, I also noticed when you build too many levels of filters, you can also be in your in crowd. So selecting very wisely the type of sources that you follow and that are in line again with your values. For example, for myself, it would be the Economist would be my weekly opening up to the world, what's going on. Not that I read everything. I'm not able to digest all of that. But I think there it's too easy to only follow your friends or a couple of peers. That's also not what you want. You want to be open enough, yet curated at a certain moment. And some of the platforms have such smart curation algorithms that they get you very easily into a certain flow. So there I would complement that with, you know, the user-generated content. I would complement that with some kind of sources that you feel you want to be influenced by. You don't want to be dominated by all kind of populist or too dominant kind of news outlets.
But you make such a good point, because the algorithm just takes you into a direction of,
yeah,
you see one piece of content, maybe you dwell on it a little bit more, and then it keeps pushing and pushing.
It's
and then
self-fulfilling, you know.
Yeah. And that's, as a person, you know, just for a personal growth, you don't want to stay in that space, because that space is very, you know, it's like an echo chamber. So how do you escape it? How do you do it?
For example, on Medium, I have a look at what is resonating on a weekly basis. I need to admit that I don't know how much it is steered by my own behavior. And I think the first step is to being aware that you're influenced based on what you click on. On the other hand, if we say these are the top articles and we are allowing ourselves to be open to explore and having a bit of time during the week to just explore, learn, and be curious, I think that's amazing. On LinkedIn, I have a couple of people that I follow. Sometimes I save it for later. On Medium, the same, but on intervals, not every day. I don't want to be overloaded with new stuff on daily basis. But on weekly level, yes, Friday afternoon, read a bit. Let's be curious. Let's see what's going on in the world. And then you find new worlds. On AI, for example, the superhuman kind of channel is fantastic. But
yeah,
probably
it's a great newsletter.
Great newsletter. And maybe in 1 year, it's going to be another one. And so it's also about discovery. And sometimes some new folks 1 year ago, I didn't know about Ali Abdaal as a productivity guru. But yeah, even though he advocates certain content that is already there for decades. So it can change every year, but being open to be influenced and to experiment on the content that you like, the news outlets that are maybe ingrained, for me, it's The Economist, for example, that's okay. And so you complement and you flow a little bit beyond that.
So that's that makes sense. Yeah, no, it absolutely. And I always use this concept that is called content diet. I'm curating my content diet on a daily basis because it's really easy to get pulled into directions that you don't really want to go into. People that you're following, and then, you know, your feed is inundated with their type of content that maybe you liked once, but you don't want to see every day. You know, pages that you follow, you know, the algorithm, as we said, on different social media platforms. I'm curious what your personal relationship to social media overall is, because LinkedIn is obviously more for professional use. And there you mentioned kind of you, it's not every day that you're on and so on. What about the rest of social media from the point of view of you're also working with it? So the one personal challenge that I always face is how to be a good marketer and not be on social media all the time. Because there's so much influence, right? There's so much cultural shift that happens on social media. So you kind of want to keep up with that. There's so much shift in algorithms and technology and wanting to keep up with all of that. Now, having said that, obviously you cannot keep up with everything because things are changing so, so fast. What is your personal approach to that?
For me, it's professional first. And so because I have the luxury of being in touch with some of the platforms very closely, like a Twitter, we have been working for 5+ years. So I've been on the first row to see what's evolving in terms of product functionality. So it was more that kind of professional hat than purely a private hat. On a private level, it's mainly to stay in touch with people, but also to see some kind of, you know, entertainment and fun content. If it's on inspiration, it's for me a bit beyond social media, and it's rather on podcasts. And it's not because we're today in a podcast that I say that, but for example, the Tim Ferriss podcast I have been following for more than 10 years. And so there he has been navigating me towards different directions. So that's from a private development point of view, personal development point of view, of great impact. And of course, there I followed some of his social media channels to just be aware of what is new in terms of content, or to navigate from some of his guests to their channels. And sometimes they're bigger on Instagram, or they're really active on Twitter, or they have their own podcast. So then it depends a bit. Where do you have your interests on a private level, and which platform would be the best one to pursue?
And I would agree. I think that the shift for me personally as well has been more towards individuals, personalities, as opposed to entities that I'm following for inspiration, especially. I think information is different because, as you said, you follow different news outlets. There's also social media involved. So there's a bit of a mix. And it's our own individual obligation to curate the type of content that we follow and get educated by.
And maybe, Joanna, maybe it's a bit old school, but I still love to go to a regular conference. And I like to talk to people, but I also like to go to a place where there is good content and maybe speakers or content that I'm just not aware of. In September, I went to a big one in Amsterdam on leadership. And there I got exposed to thinkers that I was not aware of. Same thing goes for my basically professional key focus on the insights industry. Just walking in certain rooms based on a title or some kind of hint from someone that says, hey, this is really cool, or a client that speaks with an agency. There you can be inspired and you can discover. So for me, it's a lot about finding those key blocks of time where you can discover.
And the most underrated thing, which is actually connecting and speaking to people, you know, because I feel like for me, and one of the reasons, to be honest, that I started this podcast was I wanted to just be able to speak to more people out of my physical network. You know, because during the day we're so busy and we're just absorbed by all the deliverables that we need to kind of, right? And the KPIs and the things that we need to deliver on a daily basis within our jobs, that when is there time to actually have a conversation like this one, to learn from other people, from other industries, you know, from other experiences? And I always find that it's so interesting to have conversations one-to-one, and also, as you say, in person, at conferences, at events, where you can actually really connect and get to know new people.
And at the conference, you have a conversation starter, and there you get to know people, because many of them are open to have a conversation, because otherwise they wouldn't be there.
Exactly. That's the purpose of the event. You mentioned earlier a little bit about your personal development journey as well, and the things that inspire you, like podcasts you mentioned, and, you know, leadership conferences. What makes the job of a CEO most challenging these days?
Beyond going for a stereotype, if I just speak for myself, is the constant change of the company. And so once we were at 5, then with 10, then with 30, then with 100, today 160, and we're now, today we were talking, what if the structure is 300 people? Sounds all logical, but yet it means a different role as a CEO. And what I love is to let people develop themselves, to create servant leadership, but at the same time, to be able to set a vision and a mission that inspires people. What I do love in our company, for example, it's a lot about knowledge workers, a lot of interesting people that can help and inspire each other. From a business point of view, since COVID, it's not an easy time. So because we still need to pay the bills, we still need to pay salaries, there is inflation. A lot of challenges. Clients can say, you know, budgets are locked because we have ABC in terms of challenges, or this market is this, or luxury goes that, or we have production problems here, or financing is more expensive. So there is more volatility. It's more of a VUCA world today. And I think that makes it very interesting, but also challenging. What my personal approach is to be transparent on monthly level, on quarterly level, to try to say what's going well, what's maybe shitty, where do we have challenges. And what I find the most important is that people say, okay, there is an issue or a challenge, but we're working on it and we see the steps to make it happen. And that's for me very, very important. But also for me, this is a journey, of course. It's not that I've been running multiple companies before.
I don't feel that this volatility is ever going to go away anymore.
No, most probably not. And I studied in Singapore and in Hong Kong, and that was for me as this little Belgian, you know, opening the world, like where there's double-digit growth and so many people and so much activity. And then there was Lehman Brothers going down. And it seems like ever since .com before, okay, then I was a bit younger, but still you have these crazy cycles that are going on, and there's always a new cycle. Unfortunately, there is war also nowadays again. There is a lot of migration, and it influences us as business leaders how we need to cope with that. You know, what happened to Europe, my first reflex was, okay, what does it mean for us as a business? In COVID times, for us, it was also opportunity. Some people were relying too much on lab-based face-to-face research. We said, okay, we can help you going online. And we had more than 50% growth, whereas other research businesses, poof, were all of a sudden down. So it's rather about the agility of seeing what is possible, what is a healthy kind of opportunity, but also not doing crazy jumps per se. We need to do stuff with AI. How can it enable us? But you also don't want to do AI washing neither. So it's finding always that balance within that change of having something, continuing to build on that and being open for what's new.
And how do you think, because What I'm observing is that what you just described doesn't only happen within businesses, but it just happens across the board, you know, in, you know, for jobs, you know, individuals, solopreneurs, employees. There used to be probably maybe like 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, there was still this kind of status quo, you know, like you knew that if you if you kind of like follow the path, you know, go to school, go to a good university, study hard, get good grades, get a good job, stay the course, you'd make it, you know, you buy your house, you buy your, you know, your car, you go on holidays, everything is good, right? Life is good. Since 2008 and then COVID more recently, that seems to have completely shifted. And I don't get the feeling that's ever coming back again. So the question for me is always, how does the next 5-10 years of business life work look like?
10 years, I really don't know, Oana, but I tend to operate in cycles of maximum 5 years. So
smart.
You
never know.
You never know. And it evolves all along the way. And in our R&D team, we have iterations of 3 weeks. And I don't think we can organize our company completely in iterations of 3 weeks, but like quarters or semesters, that's generally what I think about. And to have a game plan for in 5 years on a private level, my wife, for example, works at Johnson & Johnson. Maybe we go to the States. Maybe that's possible. Why not? But to see then how that fits with our children is another thing. And I think that's exciting. And to have, you know, every day or every month to reflect, you know, are we going to change path? I think that's too tiring. But having some sticks into the ground, like this quarter, this semester, this year, this, yes. And we have a vision of how the upcoming 5 years are going to look like. But at the same time, be open for like, hey, we can evaluate and we can adapt our tactics and especially our strategy. And so the key question is, when do you have the reflection moments? When do you allow to change course? If you change course all the way, then your boat is going to be zigzagging. But yeah, many things are possible. Also now, post-COVID, so much is online. It's amazing that you and I are talking online, and now it's evident. And for me, that was already part of my life before. But yeah, I always think in possibilities, a game plan, and then adaptation.
That's very smart. And I would agree. I also see limitations as opportunities. Typically, it kind of pushes you to think outside of the box and use, maybe optimize, maximize the resources that you have available, as opposed to always trying to get more from the outside, as we were used to. Instead of that, maybe just kind of optimize what you have.
And there, it's about optimizing also your energy, both professionally, but also privately. And to see, you know, what do I really want? Am I happy in my body? Do I need to do more sports? Do I want to go for this type of step in my career? Yes or no? Do I want to spend more time with family? Do I need to be closer? Do I need to have maybe less frequency, but more intensity?
So we need to optimize our lives as well. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and your energy. And to maybe say goodbye to certain areas where energy is completely draining. Unfortunately, we need to do tax declarations. Unfortunately, we need to do some admin in business.
There are some non-negotiables in terms of energy draining things that we need to do.
Yeah. At the same time, there are people that are very excited about tax, you know, that can be very nerdy about that. That's amazing. But maybe for me, not 90% of my time.
Probably not for me either, especially not in Germany, I can tell you. That's a totally different ballgame. I love what you said about energy, because I recently have Simon Alexander Ong on my podcast, which is an amazing author and a coach, and he wrote this book, Energize. And he speaks about exactly the same thing. And maybe we can sort of end this conversation on this note, that something that I discovered last year when I read his book, this concept of managing your energy and using the positive energy and channeling that into the things that give you that positive energy and doing more things from that direction and starting to optimize, minimize, make more efficient the part that is not really giving you that much energy and it's kind of draining you. What's your personal playbook on that? What do you do to optimize your energy as a CEO, especially in this world of technology that you work in, which is so fast moving?
Yeah, I think there is a kind of cognitive energy that you need to manage. And I think my worst examples would be to have like a 4-hour strategy execution workshop with the management team, and then in the afternoon doing 8 times a 30-minute meeting. I don't think that's a very smart way of coping with your cognitive energy. Another one would be purely physical, but it all depends on how physical someone is and how much you need it. But I do believe that we as humans, especially if we are knowledge workers behind a computer all the time, please move your shoulders, move the body, go swimming, go walking, be in nature is extremely important. But then there is also something like your emotional energy or your spiritual energy. The last one is maybe something I have been under investing in. But through social contacts, relationships, people that you love, that you can be inspired, both in a private context, but also just, you know, love working with someone that can create your spirit. And that's something that I find very important. On the emotional side, yeah, if you receive too much of difficulties, of challenges, and of course we need to be in the grind and we are paid to clean up some of the mess, but you don't have any celebrations, then it's tough. Then you cannot continue. So to maintain that right spirit, I think you need to have also some moments of reflection and maybe some breaks in between before your spirit gets too low in terms of flame.
Yeah. And I guess that's the biggest asset probably that we need to protect, because that's 100%. In the end, that's what we operate on. Joris, thank you so much for your time. It was so lovely to chat with you and learn all of this around social media, eye tracking, leadership. I feel like we've covered so much ground and it's been such a nice conversation. And thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. It was lots of fun. Thank you so much for having me.